I'm the pastor of St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco. St. Francis congregation is the result of a reorganization of the two-century-old churches, a Danish church and a Finnish church, that merged in 1964 and decided to serve the neighborhood around it. So it's about 24 years old, this congregation now. And our church building was built in 1905 and dedicated 12 days before the earthquake. And it survived. So that's been it's a historical landmark, and a lot of people come just to look at the church. They come and see. St. Francis is now a congregation of about 140 members. We are located in the heart of San Francisco's 100,000 member gay community. It might, our community, there are more gay people than that living in San Francisco, but that's where we are located, is in the Castro district, which is the heart of the gay community, or has been the last few years. About 15% of our members are black. About 20% of our congregation is over 65. Some of those folks over 80, a good percentage of them are that age, and about half of our members are gay or lesbian. We have very few children, and most people walk to church. Now, before we go on, I want to say a word about the terms gay and lesbian, where they came from. The term lesbian comes from Greek mythology, from the Isle of Lesbos, which was inhabited by women, and it is a term that has been used by lesbian women for many years because of that, because of the roots back then. The term gay comes from a later period in the 1920s, when a group of homosexual men in Europe decided to come out and to form a community and association, and they called themselves a gay community and identified themselves that way. And so as black people prefer to be called blacks and be identified as blacks rather than Negroes, which is the term that white people gave them for many, many years, so gay people prefer not to be called homosexuals, but to be called gay people, or lesbian, as the case may be. Who are the gay people? Most of our gay and lesbian members of our congregation and of the 13 congregations in San Francisco have come from very traditional backgrounds, from Lutheran churches in all parts of the country. Most of the people who are members, gay people who are members of our church, are not people who are new to the Lutheran church, but have grown up in the Lutheran church. They have come from small towns and from suburbs and from cities and from rural areas, from very traditional families, and have very traditional ties to their families. They have brothers and sisters who are married and who have children, and so on like that. When we talk about gay and lesbian people, we're not talking about people who are not yet in the Lutheran Church or who live only in San Francisco or New York. We're talking about people who are everywhere. It is usually estimated that from 7 to 10% of the general population are gay or lesbian, and that they are in every walk of life. So if there are 500 members in your congregation, you can pretty much determine that anywhere from 35 to 50 of those people are gay or lesbian people. They may not be out, and they may not let that be known. They may only know it to themselves. And they're not all young people. Some people are elderly. We have In one of our groups, we have a 73-year-old lesbian woman. Some are married and keeping their homosexuality a secret. And some of those people are teenagers and just struggling and trying to figure out, you know, who they talk to about this. And usually it's no one. They are afraid, and they especially do not want to talk to their parents about it. That's the thing that they're most frightened of. And some of our pastors in the Lutheran Church are gay, as they are in all denominations. And they, too, for the most part, are not, what we say, out of the closet, or not open about their being gay. We know that there are, because they call us, because we have appeared in many publications in the church over the years, and people call us from all over the country just to talk so that where they can be honest with who they are and what they're about. So we're not talking about 7 to 10% of the population that we're presently not reaching. We are talking about people who are already in our congregations and in our families. Some of you here may have gay children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews or brothers or sisters, because that's who we're talking about. Now, we can't possibly cover all of the issues and questions that come up in people's minds in our session tonight or in the one that we have on Friday or the one we have on Saturday. We're going to talk about who the gay people are today. And on Friday, we're going to talk about homosexuality in the Bible. And on Saturday, we're going to hear from some parents who have gay children by way of a videotape. Normally, when I make these presentations, we have real parents. You know, we have the real people here. But in this place, we're not able to do that. Also, we'll at the end of the session today recommend some books to you that are in the bookstore, and there's some materials over here that you can pick up and take for free. My interest in this issue and in this ministry is pastoral. I am not gay. None of my three grown children are, and no one in my family is that I know of. I have had absolutely no experience with this until about 12 years ago. I have served this congregation now for nearly 7 years. Prior to that, I was an executive on the staff of the Synod, and prior to that, I served a church in Southern California in Huntington Beach for 14 years, which was a traditional suburban congregation. I know now that there were several gay people in that church, and in a couple of cases they were married, and there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of struggle around that issue, but I was pretty much, you know, ignored it or was blind to it or didn't want to deal with it, whatever all the reasons were. But that's what happened. I just kind of chose to ignore it. Well, having said all that, let's talk a little bit about how you and I and the 90% of heterosexual people react to gay men and lesbian women. James B. Nelson, who is a professor of Christian ethics at United Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, wrote about 12 years ago in a book that was published by Augsburg Publishing House that there are four possible stances that one can take toward homosexuality. And these four stances is there any chairs left? No, just park yourself back there.
Lots of floor screens.
One, he said, the one possible stance that a person can take is what is called a rejecting punitive stance. This is basically the stance that says that gay people are queers, and they are perverts, and they are a danger to society. They molest children. They are a cancer on society, and they ought to be done away with, pushed out, and pushed aside, and made to change. Now, this was the same attitude, for example, that the Nazi regime had in Europe in the 30s, in which 300,000 gay people were gassed, along with 6 million Jews and gypsies and other people who were thought to be undesirables, including elderly people. So this is a rejecting punitive kind of stance, and you find this kind of stance in some groups today, but most people in the church today, even in the very conservative churches, would not take this kind of stance. The second stance is one of, although this was the, this there are still plenty of laws, in half the states there is against the law for people to engage in same-sex relations, and they're subject to criminal prosecution if the district attorney chooses to press charges. So it's still very much a part of our society. The other is a rejecting non-punitive stance. And what this says is that, gay people are sinners, and what they do is wrong, and they are perverts, but they shouldn't be punished. That's something that they have chosen, and as long as they stay out of the way and in the closet and aren't around normal people, that's okay, and that's fine. But they're entitled to their jobs and civil rights and so on like this, but we don't want to punish them. But we don't want them to be part of our society. The next possible stance, he said, is qualified acceptance. And this kind of a stance, it says, is that we understand that gay people and lesbian women, gay men and lesbian women, have a different orientation than the majority population. And we don't know why that is, but that's a fact of life, and that's the way it is. And they have chosen to be that way, or they have discovered themselves to be that way, whatever the situation is. They should be allowed to live in our society and belong to our churches and so on like this. But there are certain things that we just cannot find acceptable. And one is that they cannot be ordained as ministers in the church unless they do not practice their homosexuality, unless, in other words, they do not act it out. Or they should not teach in the schools, or they should not be in any kind of situation. So there's an acceptance of gay people and lesbian people, but qualified. On a familial level, this is that parents say to their son or daughter, look, we love you and we want you to come home for Christmas, but you cannot bring your lover with you that you've been with for 20 years or 10 years or whatever. You can come home for Christmas, but don't bring what's his name or what's her name around. That kind of thing. So that's a qualified kind of acceptance. And finally, the last stance is an unqualified acceptance, which says that gay people are the same as heterosexual people, just different. And the fact that they are different isn't any different than that some people are right-handed and some people are left-handed. Some people have brown eyes, some people have blue eyes. And that they have a different orientation, and that they are accepted fully in every part of life, just as we accept left-handed people and so on and so forth. So those are the four possible stances that one can take over and against homosexuality. And probably you find yourself on one of these places here, And I can tell you that I have been in all four of these positions at a point in my life. And when I was in the Navy, it was very clear that I was right here. And that anybody who was in the Navy and who was caught, found out to be queer, why they ought to be strung up by the yardarm and all those things that we said at that time. Well, how do we account for our negative reaction to homosexuality, we who are heterosexual? I don't think it's because of the Bible, because most of us don't know that much about the Bible anyway, and we know very little about what the Bible has to say about homosexuality, because it doesn't say very much at all. I think we might gain some insight from what Dwight Oberholzer, who is a sociologist at Pacific Lutheran University, said in a lecture I attended of his about 10 years ago. He says that the reaction of what we would call an emotional reaction or a rejection, hostility toward homosexuals. He says there must be some part of our consciousness that is stirred by the mental picture of homosexuality. He says it must come to the forefront with the suggestion of homosexuality. And we don't know what that is. He says that's a mystery. But he asks these questions. Is all the talk about homosexuality merely a cover for our emotional reaction to sexuality, period? And he goes on to say this. He says, those who rail against homosexuality today sound very much like the people who railed against masturbation in the last century, 100 years ago. These are some of the things that people said 100 years ago. They said that masturbation was an unnatural and psychologically damaging practice, producing a vacant look. And it was physically damaging, resulting in pallid skin. The power of the anti-masturbation forces was so strong that some people got elected to public office on an anti-masturbation platform. That's the truth. Especially the local offices, school boards, city councils, and so on. Now, why the furor over masturbation? Obviously, the harm it did was not the reason. Just as the harm it does is not the reason for the reaction against homosexuality. The demonstrated harm that gay people do is so slight and so identical to that which the heterosexuals do in much greater numbers, because we're 90% of the population, rather than 10, is so identical that he says, I cannot understand the viciousness of the assault on gay people by the heterosexual society. The only explanation, says Dr. Oberholzer, is that there must be some part of our consciousness that is stirred by homosexuality that we don't understand. I've got some other theories that I'll share with you. The thought of doing it, of having sex with another man, to me is repulsive. And for most women, it is repulsive for them to think of it doing with another woman. But if we calm down a minute, you know, don't just react, like you just calm down a minute and think about it. Aren't there a lot of people that the thought of having sex with is repulsive? Mm-hmm. Does that mean that they are sinners? And shouldn't be pastors? And shouldn't teach in our schools? Because I don't like liver and onions, can't stand it, does that mean that those who want to eat liver and onions should go in a closet somewhere and not let anybody know about it, not flaunt it, right? I have another theory. We imagine gay people, we get a mental picture of two men having sex. Now for men, two women having sex is not nearly so repulsive. In fact, it must have a certain amount of appeal because Penthouse magazine publishes pictures just about every issue, they tell me. Of women having sex together. But I wonder if it might be connected to something that I said on Monday regarding the homeless. And that is that we have a whole reaction against excrement. And the idea of men having sex with men, anal intercourse, brings up all the things that our mothers said to us while they were toilet training us. Mm. And we're repulsive. I don't know. It's just a theory. But I can tell you this, that after 7 years of dealing with gay and lesbian people and hearing hundreds of stories, all of which start out the same way, I found out I was gay when I was about 14, but I just said, no, it can't be. It was too horrifying a thought. I've come to the conclusion that people do not choose to be gay any more than people choose to be left-handed or right-handed. The people discover that they are gay, and usually with a great deal of trauma, mostly to themselves, because what is wrong with me? Here I am, all my friends are interested in girls, and all I can think about is that cute guy in algebra. What's wrong with me? And they carry this, most kids do, all through their high school years. And when they graduate from high school, they want to go away to college to get away from everything. And thinking that in college they'll find the right girl, as mom and dad promised. Because you haven't dated much in high school. Now, because our church, St. Francis, has for many years been open to gay and lesbian people and has been welcoming of them, when I was interviewed 7 years ago to be pastor of the church, they asked me, one of the questions that they asked of me and all of the other candidates is, how did I feel about serving and being a pastor to gay and lesbian people? And so that's something that I had to confront right then. Of course, I had fortunately lived in San Francisco a couple of years, and because there's so many gay people, and out of the closet, you're confronted with it and you have to deal with it. You have to deal with it, as all of us do in the city. We are a Reconcile in Christ congregation which has publicly declared itself to be welcoming of gay and lesbian people. The current president of our congregation is a gay man who is a college professor, and he's in his early 40s, and he has been with the same man for 20 years. They just had their 20th anniversary. And last year, the president of our congregation was a trial lawyer from Minneapolis, and he and his wife, originally from Minneapolis, he and his wife they live in Berkeley, and they have members there. In fact, they're coming up in about 10 days, along with about 10 other people from our church up here to hold it. We can't wait for them to get here. because even though there's a lot of people here, it gets a little lonely sometimes when you see folks you don't know. So gay people are involved in every aspect of the life of our church, and we talk about it. And we do the normal things that congregations do. We have potlucks, and we have counseling for individuals and for married couples and for gay couples. And a lot of work with parents. An organization of which I'm a member called Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays meets in our church, and we together often make presentations to high schools and to other churches and so on like that, different clubs.
Are high schools pretty open to have you come in? Yeah.
Depends. They are open to having parents come in. But the reason that you recognize that you have to do this is because more and more young people are coming out to their counselors, their school counselors. Mm-hmm. Those are very often the first people that they come out to. And so school counselors have to be taught how to deal with this. And one of their greatest resources, of course, are parents of gay children. I also should mention that right now we're dealing with a lot of problems with AIDS, although I must say that the rate of increase in San Francisco has leveled off and gone down in some cases. It's the younger gay people. See, we just found out what this was in 1981. And so the theory is that most of the people who are now coming down with AIDS were infected before 1981. And so most of the younger gay people now are practicing safe sex. And so So most of the people who are coming down with AIDS are over 30. The gay population. That's not true of the heterosexual population. That's a different story. But that's another whole issue, the whole issue of AIDS. Now, when I said a few minutes ago that 7 to 10% of the people in the general population are gay, probably some of you said, well, there aren't any in our church. Or aren't any in our school, as some kids told their pastor. That's because our stereotypes of gay people. Can you close the door, please? That's because our stereotypes of gay people are that they are, they have limp wrists, and they talk like this. And they're hairdressers, and they Mr. Phyllis, and all that. We have all these stereotypes of gay people, of gay men, and they're all real flamboyant and wear clothing, and that the women are all butchy, they're all dykes on bikes, and they're tough and hard and so on like that. Those are stereotypes, and they don't fit. They don't fit. There are indeed some gay people who are like that, but that's not the majority. Let me just tell you here, this is a man who died. I'm going to read his obituary. Frank J. Sutton. The 54-year-old Mr. Sutton was senior vice president and managing associate for FCI Asset Management at the time of his death. Previously, he had been trust officer for Security Pacific National Bank, Liberty National Bank, and the Chartered Bank of London. Active in a number of banking organizations, Mr. Sutton also was on the board of the San Francisco Foundation from 1970 through 1980. That's a foundation that is a philanthropic organization that manages several million dollars. He was on the board of the Human Rights Foundation and was a key figure in backing the Gay Freedom Day Marching Band and the Golden Gate Performing Arts Foundation. He donated generously to the Pride Foundation, Free Willers, the Gay Games, Laguna Honda Hospital, and Opera for Seniors. Mr. Sutton was profiled in a 1979 documentary by CBS, Gay Power, Gay Politics. A native of Clinton, Iowa, Mr. Sutton was nicknamed Burley after a famed Pittsburgh Pirate baseball pitcher, Burley Grimes. He was a graduate of the University of Iowa and its law school and was an officer in the Navy's Judge Advocate Corps before coming to San Francisco in 1962 and entering the banking field. Mr. Sutton is survived by two sisters, Carlin Fellows of Iowa City, Iowa, and Barbara Price of Clinton, Iowa, and his longtime companion, Dumont Howard of San Francisco. Tom Trigard, the president of our congregation, grew up in San Jose in a very Lutheran family. His grandfather was a Lutheran pastor. He has a sister who's married and has children. He knew he was gay all the time, he says, and he told his parents, about it, and they said, "Oh, you know, kind of that kind of thing." They were Swedish, you know, you don't react too much. And Tom, when he was about 19 and he was in college, well, he decided that he wasn't going to be any different, and so he started to do what most young men do at that age, and eventually he met someone, and he and David have been together ever since. Tom owns a home. Looks after his aged aunt, who is childless. She's 87 or 88, very frail, but very sharp in the mind. And eventually, at some point, he is going to probably take her into his home. He also had his 96-year-old grandmother, who he took out of a nursing home where his father had put her, and brought her into his home and had her cared for until she died. Close to her parents, and her father taught her to fly, insisted that she learn to fly, which she does. She graduated from the University of California in San Diego with honors. She was president of her Walter Lake, taught Sunday school. Lisa came out while she was in college. She dated boys when she was in high school, but she knew that it wasn't right. Lisa is a paralegal, 26 or 27 years old. She is making something around between $35,000 and $40,000 a year, and Lisa's decided to go to seminary. Has remained involved in church all of her life. Steve is from North Dakota, the oldest of seven children. His father is an automobile dealer. His mother is a nurse. All of his brothers and sisters are straight. Steve is gay. His parents will not come to visit him for fear of getting AIDS. And every time that he goes home, they don't talk about it. And when he has conversations, they talk about the weather, and they talk about his job, but they don't talk about this, and that's the way it's been for 10 years. Greg Egertson is the oldest of six boys. His father is a pastor, his grandfather is a pastor. Some of you might know Paul Egertson. I don't know any of you here from the West Coast, but anyway, his grandfather is a pastor. One of the nicest young men that I think that I have ever met. He was an honor student in high school and also at California Lutheran University. And Greg has been going back and forth at the seminary, and now he's going to have his internship year at St. James here in Portland this fall, and next spring he will graduate from the seminary in Berkeley, and his picture is in one of those things over there you can pick up. Then I would like to just read you something briefly from a letter from Tom Davis, who is the parish administrator at one of our neighboring congregations in San Francisco. Tom is gay. He is not Lutheran. But he wrote this letter to Bishop Chilstrom last April in response to Bishop Chilstrom is our national bishop of the Lutheran Church. And in the pastoral letter that he wrote to all of the clergy in all of the congregations of the entire ELCA, all 5.3 million of us, and explaining why it is that gay people should be accepted, but they should not be ordained. In other words, it is okay to be homosexual, but it's not okay to practice the homosexuality. It's not okay to act it out. That is sinful. Dear Bishop Chilstrom, this is a little long, but I don't think it's too tiresome here. I read your pastor letter of March 20th, 1988, and I should like to make some comments and raise some questions which I consider of vital importance. I am not a Lutheran, but I spend 8 hours a day working for a Lutheran congregation, so I do have some interest in what is going on in the denomination. In addition, I feel qualified to enter into dialogue with you since I hold a Master of Divinity degree from Howard University School of Religion in Washington, D.C. My thesis topic in 1968 was Counseling the Homosexual in a Pastoral Setting. First, you seem to me to have become conversant with the whole topic of homosexuality in a pastoral context. And in that process, your viewpoint has moved rather in a liberal direction. That is all to the good, I think. Some of your statements, though, I should like to hear clarified. In your first statement concerning choice of homosexual orientation, I think it would be helpful to point out, especially since most of your readers will be heterosexual persons, that homosexual individuals simply become aware of the objects of their desires in precisely the same way that heterosexuals do. It is something that happens to them, except that in most cases it is a discovery which issues in anxiety, depression, furtiveness, denial, even suicide. For heterosexuals, the discovery of sexual attraction to the opposite sex is a source of excitement, titillation, and importantly, belonging to the social peer group. Listen carefully someday to the way junior high school students talk about faggots and queers, and you will understand what I mean. Remind yourself, too, that the foundation for all the vicious hatred directed toward persons of a homosexual orientation in this society was laid by the Jewish and Christian religions. You say you are convinced that many, emphasis, homosexual persons cannot change their orientation. Would you make a similar statement about heterosexual orientation? How many heterosexuals do you know who have changed and become homosexuals? Let me assure you that the number is exactly the same, vice versa. Prayer and counseling may have helped certain persons to perform heterosexual acts or to curtail the expression of their homosexual orientation, but I am quite sure that there have been no genuine changes in orientation, assuming the subject was really of homosexual orientation to begin with. You speak of homosexual orientation as a strong inclination, rather like an overwhelming passion for strawberries. Do you look at your own heterosexual orientation in the same light? Or is it part and parcel of your identity as a person? Is your family just the result of a strong inclination toward women on your part? Are you prepared to say that your identity as a man, as a red-blooded American, as a bishop even, is not in the same incalculable way bound up with your heterosexuality? What if you woke up tomorrow morning and found yourself thinking about what it would be like to kiss Clint Eastwood instead of Dolly Parton? Would you not feel that the very basis of your world was being shaken? Sexual orientation is not just a strong inclination, an incidental appetite. It is interwoven with the very being of the person. Imagine what it must be like to discover that because people despise you, not just on the basis of a matter of taste, but because of who you are, and that God and the church don't like you for the same reason. Okay. That's as far as we can go tonight, as far as presentation is concerned, but I'd like to open it up for questions. And I will, in the meantime, before I forget, because I usually do, there are a couple of books I want to recommend. One is that if you have a gay child,
celibacy, is that correct?
That's correct, except that it is expected, it's always been implied. In other words, the expectation on the part of the church has always been that the clergy who are single would be celibate. And that was the expectation, but nobody was ever asked whether they were.
You're talking about the Catholic Church?
No, I'm talking about the Lutheran Church.
Are you talking about homosexuals that are asked to be celibate?
Yes, the three men who were certified for ordination last December and were out of the closet and said, in other words, they were openly saying that they were gay people, and they were asked by their bishops and the Division for Ministry in Chicago to say that they had a promise that they were not now, nor would they ever be, in a relationship. In other words, that they would remain celibate all of their lives in order for them to be recommended to a congregation for call. Now, the same request was not made of the heterosexual single students.
I thought one of them, though, had said he would remain celibate for X number of years.
He said he would have. He said
that, no.
Yeah, he said that when he did get involved. That was Jeff Johnson. But since then, the bishop has withdrawn that because he said that because he couldn't promise that he would be forever.
No, I didn't get that answer.
Yeah, that's fairly recent. Yeah, that happened before I came. We had a very hot meeting with the bishop over that one.
I knew a pastor in my teenage years at Luther League Camp who was gay. Mm-hmm. We didn't know it at the time. And I think most of us, for years that we attended camp, had him placed right next to God. And, you know, he wrote our camp songs, and you probably know the choruses. And he was just a wonderful man. But I think it was a problem for his wife. But I don't think it was a problem for anyone in his congregation.
Really?
He was not in my congregation. He was out of town. But...
Did you know it then?
No, we didn't know it, and we were very shocked when we found out about it. But he had done so much good. I think the church lost a lot.
Yes, I have two assistant pastors, both of whom are very gifted and are gay. And they work full-time at other jobs, but we have given them calls, and so they do. But they would be wonderful pastors to congregations. And the city is, I mean, I have, there are two pastors that are on my staff, but we have about three or four other former pastors in the congregation. We have one man who came out at about 50. Never married yet. Yes, sir.
Is there any physical way of telling whether a man or a woman is gay or lesbian?
No. Sometimes.
Are there any hormonal deficiencies or differences, would you say?
I'm not a gentologist. I'm not a physician. It's not genealogy. That's when you try to find out.
Gynecology.
But anyway, I'm not familiar with genetics. That's what I'm trying to look for. So I can't really answer that question, but now you have to remember too is that you have to make a distinction between, there are some people who are women trapped in a man's body, or a man trapped in a woman's body. Now that's something different. That's something totally different. There are also people who say who like to dress up in women's clothing. Most of those folks are heterosexual, have families and so on. They just like to dress up in women's clothing. Now that's something entirely different. When you're talking about homosexuality, you're just talking about someone who is attracted to someone who is of the same sex as they are. And why that is, we don't know. But the preponderance of evidence seems to be from everything that you found out, it is something that happens either in the womb or shortly thereafter.
You think there'd be some physical or, physical?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there are gay people who are truck drivers, and there are gay people who are dancers. You know, and there are women, there are gay women who are fashion models, and there are gay women who, you know, who work in warehouses. And, so you really can't characterize. You know, there are some men who are effeminate but are heterosexual. And there are some women who are very masculine, but are heterosexual. So you can't tell.
Are there degrees of this? I mean, I'm thinking, if I meet a group of couples,
mm-hmm.
I find that in my interest in conversation with these people, I'll come away and I will have remembered the women, but I really can't quite remember who all the men were in that group.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, women have a tendency to sit over here and discuss recipes, and the men talk about cars.
Yeah, that, and in some cases, that's true. One of the things is that, like, the studies have been that we are all on some kind of a spectrum. Of like, here's homosexuality and here is heterosexuality, and most of us are somewhere on that spectrum. We're not either all homosexual or heterosexual or all homosexual. Now that doesn't have to do with genital sex. That has to do with attraction, or just like there are some men who prefer the company of men more than they prefer the company of women. Now that doesn't mean that they're homosexual, they're gay. You know, and that there are some women who prefer the company of women more than they do men. That doesn't mean that they're homosexual. It's just that we find ourselves, and there are some women who are, it is more acceptable for women, for example, to hold hands and so on like this, and we don't think any of men to hold hands, except I think in some cultures men do that. You know, some of you travel a lot. Men are much more touching and feeling. I mean, most of us who come out of a Northern European heritage, you know, yeah. We shake hands with our grandmother.
The letter to Bishop Chilstrom that you read.
Yeah.
What was his connection with the church, and was this a gay man?
Yes, he's a gay man.
And who was he again?
He's a parish secretary administrator in one of our neighboring churches in San Francisco.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, Bishop Chilstrom received thousands of letters. A lot more. His mailbag is full. Yes.
Our concept today then is that it's not just a psychological disorder, but right. That in fact that they part of the person's orientation to life.
Right.
Totally.
That's my experience. And most people who have been involved with all gay people and gay people themselves say that. You know, and the efforts at trying to, what they've been able to do with behavioral aversion therapies is that they've been able to take homosexual people and turn them off to homosexuality, but they haven't been able to turn them on to heterosexuality. They haven't been able to. So that kind of, it's been more damaging than it is now.
Isn't it also true that some homosexuals are also heterosexual, that they...
There are some people who are bisexual.
Yes.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I have a little thing here from Dear Abby. Recently. Dear Abby, I saw you on the Phil Donahue show recently and was delighted when you said there is far more bisexuality around than anyone suspects. I am a male, 64, and have been married for more than 40 years. I was a pilot in World War II, had a few flings with women, married shortly after the war, and fathered several fine children. When I was 27, my employer sent me and another male employee whom I admired to a one-week training program in another city. We shared a motel room with twin beds. This man had also been in the service and had a lovely wife and one child, as did I at the time. On the third night, we had no homework, so we went to a topless bar, had a few drinks, and went back to our motel. Amid a little horseplay and rib poking, we kind of fell on one of the beds together. That was the beginning of a very long bisexual relationship. He died 2 years ago, and I have grieved ever since. Not once in all those years was there any indication that there was anything between us, either at work or in the presence of our families. I loved that man, and he loved me. Our relationship lasted for 40 years, and neither of us took anything away from our families. It was far more than sexual attraction. We were best friends, closer than brothers. His children called me uncle. I know that bisexuality is frowned upon by others, but I have no regrets. In the closet in Cleveland. And Abby says, read on. Dear Abby, I'm surprised that you were surprised by the number of bisexuals that surfaced in your survey. I am a male bisexual. The mental health professionals probably include us in the 10% labeled gays. True, the majority of bisexuals use the gays for same-sex relations. You are correct to question percentages, Abby. We bisexuals are so closeted, we don't even know each other. We are in your heterosexual world, usually happily married, helping to rear our children with the same moral, ethical, caring values as you. We may be pillars of the community and part of that lovely family down the street. We cross all ethnic and financial lines. Most of you know one of us and consider us your close heterosexual friend, working buddy, or acquaintance. Although this letter has little chance of reaching your readers, in order to protect my job, wife, children, heterosexual and bisexual friends, I must sign myself no name, no town. So, yeah.
I was wondering if there are, or what are the legal movements now to make marriage between gay men and lesbians legal?
There isn't, the gay community, they're not talking about marriage. They say marriage, marriage is something that belongs to the heterosexual community, but they're talking about covenants and unions, and a lot of people have done that. We don't do that in our church for a number of reasons, but primarily because it's against church policy, national church policy. But the reason for that is because, let me give you a for instance. A gay couple may have been together for 15 years. One of them dies. Okay, they purchased a house together. They've done furniture, they've built a life together. One of them dies. The guy that died, his family comes into town, comes in the apartment and pushes the lover out of the way, takes the stuff. He has no rights. He has nothing. No rights. So that's the thing. So that's why a lot of, most gay people are pretty meticulous about making wills and stuff like that, and having things and joint tenancy and stuff like that. Although I must say, not all are. But I run into that all the time, and we always have four or five people who are dying of AIDS, and we have the situation again and again where the family comes into town and they find out that their son is gay and they find out he's dying in the same week.
So would you, what do you think about that? Do you think there should be, I'm not thinking of, legal taxes, same as you, as far as this no rights to each other?
You're asking my personal opinion?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that if you're where I am in the spectrum of unqualified acceptance, but I think that, gay people and gay couples ought to be given the same legal rights, as all other couples.
So is there a movement in the legislature to start something like that?
Oh yeah, there's legislation that's been introduced, but it usually doesn't get out of committee. Mm-hmm. That's it. Yes, sir.
Did I understand you earlier to say that this starts in infancy? At the same time, did I hear you say that you're going into schools and talking on this subject? Is it because, let me go on and just ask you why I'm asking this question. In the schools such as, like the drugs and everything now, there's a tendency, even prior to the time that they come in to talk about this, that the kids want to try it out. Is this a case that any of that, from the standpoint of, even if they don't have that, or could that be a case of, well, maybe we ought to try that out?
Well, let me just pose this question. How old are your grandchildren?
Oh.
Do you have a granddaughter about 9 or 10 years old?
No. Great grandchildren.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. But 9 or 10 year old girls, when they're asked about boys are icky. Boys are icky. And when girls find out, I'll never forget this, 12 or 13 year old girl was asking her parents about how babies are made, you know, and it was a dinner table conversation. And they explained it to her, and it said, finally you could see the pieces were falling together, and she says, Daddy, you did that to Mother 4 times?
Yeah, three brothers.
So, in other words, the attitudes of the kids are, you know, I think mostly what we want to do when we go into kids is to get kids to stop persecuting, using terms like sissy and faggot and queer, you know, and homo and all those kinds of derogatory things, to get kids sensitized to that, and to recognize that if kids think that they are gay, and remember peer pressure in high school, you want to be like everybody else. And if you feel like you're different, you know, that you can feel you can go and talk to your school counselor or something like that. Now, in the case of some kid like Greg Egerton, you know, when he was about 17 or 18 years old, the first people that he came out to were his parents. He didn't talk to anybody, he went to his parents. And they were absolutely wonderful. Of course, he's got wonderful parents. I mean, I know them, they're wonderful people. And that was the thing with that, yeah.
What about where the Bible condemns it so specifically?
Well, we're going to talk about that Friday night. So I hope you'll be here. Okay?
don't you think the gay community in San Francisco does a lot of harm to their cause with that annual Halloween Day parade?
It's not the Halloween Day parade, it's the gay parade, which is on June 26th.
Oh.
And there are parades now in every major city throughout the United States. I think it does more good, actually, because what it does is that it makes the gay community visible. Now, what happens is that what shows up on national television are all of the people in their regalia. I march in the gay parade with my church, the church members, and
I
with
know,
the whole group of church.
You don't dress up like a...
I wear my collar. No. But see, that's what gets on television. You also don't see the physicians either. You don't see the physicians walking down the street, you know, holding up signs that says physicians for gay rights. So you don't see the parents. You know, the very first gay parade in New York in 68 or 69, which started the movement, well, there was one mother, and she said, parents, a mother who loves her gay son. That's what she carried. And that was the start of parents.
Oh, that I can agree with, but I've seen this parade in San Francisco where they're...
Have you seen it firsthand, or have you only seen it on television?
Yeah, no, firsthand.
Okay.
Where they were coming along dressed as women, and to me, that was a mockery.
Yeah, it's not just that, but it's a part of the whole thing. There's a carnival atmosphere also, but it's a, as someone said, it's a huge block party. And, you know, like, and people get dressed up and be outrageous, just like people do on Halloween sometimes.
Or Mardi Gras.
Or Mardi Gras. Same kind of thing that goes on.
Don't you think the media does more damage?
Well, I think that they do when they do things like that. Yeah. But the media has actually helped in recent years because of the program called My Son Eric or something, I guess, or whatever it was. And there have been some other things that are very responsible. And Ted Koppel has done some wonderful things.
Yeah.